920 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Youth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Always grateful to you for sharing part of your Saturday with me. And I hope you are able to get outside and get a little bit of that sunshine today. It is so lovely. As I always like to say, our February selves will thank us so much for soaking it up now, indeed. So lots to do on the program today. We're going to talk a little bit later in the show about, there's a lot of conversation about bike sharing going on in Chicago right now. So we're going to sort that out and talk it through. And we're going to take a look at the grocery service Peapod and how it's trying to update and shake things up a little bit, compete against things like Instacart and Amazon Fresh, all those things. But right now we're joined by Elizabeth Dwoskin, who is the Silicon Valley correspondent at Washington Post, who wrote this piece about this news going on this week. Another thing being discussed very widely right now is Facebook's plans to kind of step into the dating app space, which I think made a lot of people go, is that really the best timing? Are we really doing this right now? But nonetheless, that is the plan, as Facebook says. And so here to talk about that with us, welcome Elizabeth Dwoskin. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Okay, so talk us through this, because at first glance, we hear, you know, dating coming from Facebook in a moment when so many people are concerned with privacy and their data and how it's being used and shared. And that seems like just really maybe not great timing.
I mean, that was my reaction. I was shocked by the timing when I was at their developer conference in Menlo Park this week where they announced it. It's like, you know, the metaphor, like learning to fly a plane while flying. And,
right.
You know, or the other way I put it at is it's almost like they can't help themselves. Like they have every year they have this developer conference where they're expected to announce new things. And this year has been the worst year for them. And you would think they would just take a step back and be reflective. But they've announced something new, which is they're getting into the dating scene. And that actually, as a piece that I wrote with my colleague Drew Hartwell in the Washington Post, it brings up a whole other layer of risks, because dating apps, you know, they can be risky for people.
Definitely. And it really seemed, I mean, you know, reading the piece, and for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'm going to be sure and tweet this out after so you can read it for yourself. It's really, really compelling. But as I was reading it, I immediately was thinking, like, you're preying on vulnerability. What's going on here? Because it seems like that, what better way to get people to just share more data in a time when people are reluctant to share data?
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, Facebook, they literally are logging every keystroke and every little micro behavior on the site. And when I ask them, what are you going to be mining from this dating app? What data are you going to take? Now, of course, they're going to take all the people that you're interested in or you pass on. And we know that you know, Facebook is very interested in relationship status. Obviously, you've been able to, you know, announce your relationship status on Facebook for years. But what people don't always remember is that about 4 years ago, their own data scientists actually conducted a study with Cornell where they tried to predict, of all the people who announced their relationship status on Facebook, who would break up within 60 days. And they actually did a study. They were researching behavior. So they're interested in learning a lot about you, as we know, and folding the data up and eventually putting it into this massive advertising machine if it doesn't go already. And they told me that if you do the dating site, they're not going to use the data for advertising for now. But that's for now. And when I asked them how else you might use the data for data mining, research, whatever, they didn't say. And I was also surprised that they said that they wouldn't say, because a new law is actually coming down the pike in Europe that's going into effect. It's a whole privacy change that's going to affect the European Union that actually requires them to tell people every single use of your data. So you don't just sign away your rights with one blanket statement. You have to know every little thing. And they wouldn't tell me. So I asked them if they were planning to disclose it, and they also didn't respond.
Interesting. So other interesting things, though, that I wonder about when discussing this this announcement, when making this announcement, Zuckerberg said something I thought was really interesting. And that was that the feature is for building real long-term relationships, not just hookups. But I don't know that I really ever heard what the plan is to facilitate that, because, you know, what how could you possibly control that? So what did you have any other information on what Facebook's sort of plan was to get people into relationships as opposed to just kind of hooking up?
No, I think it's a great question. I heard that same thing when you said that, you know, this isn't for hookups, guys. And by the way, this is coming from a person who built Facebook when it was originally called Face Mesh.
Right.
Because he wanted to spy on women at Harvard. Like, this is a college, started out as a college app that was for hookups, effectively.
Right.
And so, you know, he's come a long way now. He has two daughters and is very serious and all of that. But I felt it was like, it strikes me as a little bit of like social engineering. Like, hey, we want to tell you, you know, it's only to, you know, find your love of your life and your married partner. Who knows how people use it? This is human behavior. And I think it really speaks to how Facebook sometimes sees themselves as all powerful. Like, even to make a statement like that, the much more humble thing to say was, we don't know how people will use it, but we're going to assume that this app is going to invite the diversity of sexuality and relationships mm-hmm. in all its forms, because that's actually what happens in the real world.
Right.
But the other thing is that they often have blind spots and blinders on. As you saw, you know, they build their service, but they didn't anticipate that Russians would then use it to manipulate political speech or fake news operators. So there is this thing where when I hear them say, you know, it's only going to be used for long-term relationships and not hookups, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, it's very hard for you to see the dark side of the things you build. And not that hookups are necessarily bad. There's much worse things that can happen on dating apps than that.
Right. I'm thinking in particular of another time of much lower stakes here for the most part, but when Facebook commenting was implemented at so many news organizations so that people would have to stand by their comment and not comment anonymously. And yet people got around that so easily by making fake profiles and commenting anyway and then getting banned and making another one. So exactly as you said, I don't know that they're looking at the, you know, some blind spots here that are in there. But
when they announced live video and they said this is going to be for celebrities to broadcast and people to broadcast themselves walking the dogs. I remember they had billboards of things you could do live video. And you know what people did? They live streamed themselves committing suicide, mm-hmm. in some cases torturing people, and in other cases homicides.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was an interesting beat. I think we talked about that a bit on this program, how something intended for something very light and accessible throughout different points of your day ended up being both like a 911 call and a terrible, you know, traumatic vision, like all this stuff that I'm sure there were unintended consequences. But I do think it is interesting. I will maybe give them a bit of credit that if they insist on going in this direction, I think it is interesting. One detail in this story that I thought was compelling was that you'll only be allowed to send a single message initially, and it must be text and not a photograph, to theoretically cut down on like unsolicited photographs, things like that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just to their credit, they're moving cautiously.
Yeah.
And, you know, they and also to their credit, just to say, you know, they have the largest social network in the world, mm-hmm. you know, more than 2 billion people, a third of the world's population. And, you know, that's a lot of people for single people. I mean, that's a lot of people who might want to meet one another. And you do have to say, if they did it well, I mean, it could be the most effective dating service in the world. Whether you want it to be is another question. But sometimes what people find is that privacy advocates or people get anxious because Facebook builds something, and it becomes a very mixed bag, because it becomes very successful in certain ways and then also has these unintended consequences just because of their scale. And it's sort of everything. So I want to hold out to say that this may work really, really well. But yeah, they are not going to allow people to do more than send one message, because women on dating apps get so many messages. It's like very well documented that if you're a woman on a dating app, like, you're getting messages, and sometimes the guys, they're just not serious. Like, some men, they have sort of like a spray and pray strategy to mm-hmm. dating apps. They just like message every woman that they see, that they swipe on. And so women can feel assaulted. And then, of course, people might send pornography. And the other thing is people send links. So one of the dark sides of dating apps is that actually spammers use it, and malicious actors use it to send malware. Just these Trojan horse links that you might get, like, you know, when you get a weird link in your email address, click on this link, and then suddenly your computer is infected.
Right.
Well, people do the same on dating apps. They actually create bots, and they'd ask you to click on a link. And so, you know, this would cut down on that. But on the other hand, it would also cut down on the functionality, because as we know, dating these days online is about sending each other pictures. And that just seems so obvious. So it makes me think that they expect that people will just connect and then move off to another service or to regular text messaging or things where you can actually do the things that people who are getting to know one another do.
Right. Or say if you make a typo in your first message, you want to fix that typo. I can see that going
exactly.
Oh, man, I said the dumbest thing. Indeed. And of course, there is the other part of that. And that is you don't have to be on a dating site to receive unsolicited pornography from strangers. You can just be a woman on the internet and get that all the time. We get it here all the time. Good times.
Exactly.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us about this today. Again, for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'm going to tweet this story out because it is really, really compelling, taking a look at this next move from Facebook. Elizabeth Dwoskin, Silicon Valley correspondent at Washington Post, thanks so much for being with us today.
It's great to talk with you, Amy. Thanks.
Bye-bye. WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Hope you're out there enjoying some sunshine today. Lots to do on the program still. A little bit later after the news break, we're going to be talking about bike sharing because that is something on a lot of Chicagoans' minds right now, and it is a little bit mired in controversy, so we're going to sort all that out. But right now, we're joined by Bridget Sweeney, who's a reporter at Crain's Chicago, who wrote about the grocery service Peapod and its attempts to update their model and be a little more competitive in with services like Instacart, things like that. So welcome to the program, Bridget. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Amy. Thanks so much for having me.
Gladly. Appreciate you taking time out of your Saturday to talk with us. So talk us through, it seems like suddenly Peapod is really like doubling down their efforts, doing a lot of new stuff to try to compete with there are a lot of different ways to get groceries right now. And it seems like Peapod is not satisfied with the space they've been offering and perhaps trying to grab more of that space.
Absolutely. So people who are kind of paying attention to business news probably have heard of the quote-unquote grocery wars. You know, they've been ramping up for a while. Amazon has been kind of poking around food for a long time. Obviously, with their acquisition of Whole Foods recently for, you know, almost $14 billion, that has just totally changed the game. So they are pushing these two-hour, you know, free delivery of produce and fresh foods and groceries. And Peapod, which has been doing this for a really long time, suddenly, you know, they're kind of having the rug pulled out from under them. So they are trying to push back and cut their prices, just like Amazon obviously cut prices at Whole Foods, and also offer these meal kits, which are a really increasingly popular way for busy families to, you know, still make their own meals at night but not have to do a lot of the individual shopping and, you know, pick individual ingredients. So far the company says that people are responding really well and sales are increasing thanks to these meal kits.
Yeah, I think that part of it is really interesting too, that I think, you know, I've never used one myself, but I've seen a lot of people tweeting about them. I know some people who've used them. I have a neighbor who's used them, and they talk about, they feel like there's less, you know, stuff left over. You get enough of each ingredient and then you're good. You don't have all this weird stuff lingering in the back of your fridge, things like that. So it is really interesting. Where is it that you think that Peapod first started to lose ground in this that made them kind of jump back in, trying to reclaim space?
Absolutely. So the Peapod story goes way back. I actually did not realize this until I started writing about Peapod a few years ago. It was founded back in 1989, which is crazy when you think about it. Back during the first web boom, grocery delivery was really hot. A company called Webvan was like a huge, you know, early web company that had a ton of funding. It was kind of like pets.com. It all blew up. It failed, you know, in 2001, back when the first crash happened. So Peapod hung in there. It still was going. It was founded by two brothers in an Evanston garage. And for a long time, it was really the only player in the online grocery delivery game. The problem came, I think, when they were purchased by a major grocery conglomerate, Ahold Delhaize, which doesn't have a presence in the Midwest for physical stores, but it owns Giant and Stop and Shop on the East Coast. You know, they realized, like everyone, grocery delivery is really hard and really expensive to do well. You know, you have these refrigerated trucks, You have so many logistics. If customers get, you know, bruised fruit, they're not gonna use you again. So I think things kind of stagnated because Whole Delhi's, you know, as a public company, they need to, you know, make returns for their shareholders. And then as things were stagnating, all these other players, Instacart, Amazon, now Walmart, they all kind of started creeping up and realizing that, hey, in the future, online delivery really is where customers are going to be.
There's a number that's in your story, and for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'm going to be sure and tweet this story out after the program so you can read it for yourself. It's really very interesting. There's a lot of interesting data in it. But there is a number that online grocery sales account for less than 3% of the roughly $700 billion U.S. grocery market. And that immediately makes me think of, well, why doesn't that mirror other retail more closely? And I have to assume it's, as you mentioned, like you want to, you know, if you get a bruised apple, you're not going to use them again. But you also, I think, there's something a lot more personal about food. You want to mess with your produce and look at it and pick the right one. And, we want to feel and play with our food a little bit in the store before we buy it.
Exactly, Amy. And that's the exact, kind of crux of the issue here. Online shopping in general, even though it's been a huge, you know, segment of American life for a long time now, it always, across all industries, has been slower to grow than we might imagine. You know, I'm sure you've seen the stories or the stats that until recently, even any online retail only, you know, comprised a tenth or less of overall sales, even for, you know, big, you know, clothing stores and any kind of retail. Grocery, especially, like you said, for the reasons you mentioned, is a little bit of a laggard. That is beginning to shift. Like you said, it's only 3% of the industry, so it's still tiny, but it's growing double digits every year. And just now the fact that Amazon owns Whole Foods, that has just really changed the game. They obviously are willing to spend a ton of money to get it right, to figure it out, to make customers happy. They don't care about profits. And so now all these other big players are kind of having to follow suit just to keep up. And I think also consumers, busy two job families, you know, they're getting used to the idea that, hey, we'll give up that control if these players earn our trust. You know, if they figure out how to do this and it's on time and it comes when I want it and it's in good shape, great. And if I get a bad banana or I get a bad apple, I expect a return. I expect a refund. They give it to me. Great. No problem. I'll keep doing this.
Yeah. Very, very interesting. Well, we will keep turning to you for the latest as the grocery wars continue to unfold. Bridget Sweeney, reporter at Crain's Chicago. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Amy.
All right. We're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us and sharing part of your Saturday. So if you are a social media user here in Chicago, perhaps you have heard that there is a little bit of controversy brewing around the bike share program. We have the Divvy bike stations everywhere, but there have been, since they were implemented, there was a little bit of conversation on, well, why are they in the locations they're in, or why are they only in those locations? And then there's another element that's developed recently, and here to talk with us about that, please welcome Mary Wisniewski, who is a transportation reporter and columnist at Chicago Tribune. Mary, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hi. So, talk us through this, because it seemed like when Divvy first went in, a lot of people had conversations around, well, why are they in the locations they're in, the docking stations? And then this other element, which is the dockless bikes, has been introduced just recently into the bike ecosystem in Chicago. And there is a lot of consternation around that.
Right. Well, what happened, Divvy came in a few years ago, and they wanted to put them in places where they knew there'd be a lot of circulation in order to get the program successful. So they put these docking stations in areas, they're mostly in the Loop and in the Near North Side and in Lincoln Park, and because these are places where there's a lot of people and there's a lot of stores and stuff close together. And so those would create a lot of people using the bikes. And the system has been a success, and they've been spreading it out since then. But they've had less success as they've gone into some of the south side, west side neighborhoods because, you know, partly because there might not be as much of a biking culture there. There's less biking infrastructure. And stores are not as close together. And so they've had a little bit more of a hard time getting things in there. And so they've started this Backless Bike Share program on the far south side. And what Backless Bike programs do is that instead of bikes being parked at a station, a docking station, they're free parked wherever you leave the bike. And most of them are parked with wheel locks.
And so the consternation enters because I think a lot of people seem to be saying, well, neighborhoods are not being treated fairly, regardless of what the perceived need is from the bike share companies. Neighborhoods are not being treated fairly across the city.
Right. There's, for one, you know, people want bike share everywhere, which is great because, you know, we would like to create more of a biking culture in the city. It's better for people's health. It's better for the environment. But, you know, bike companies want to be able to, and the city's Divvy program want to be able to go where, you know, it's going to be successful. And so there's been some back and forth on how, what's the best way to do that. Dockless bike share is easier and cheaper to implement because you don't need the docking stations, which, you know, cost money to maintain and to build, and you have to take space on the street for them or on the sidewalk. The dockless companies don't need that, but the problem with dockless is in other cities is that when people leaving the bikes everywhere, some people don't leave them in places that are good for other people. They park them carelessly, so they might be cluttering sidewalks. We've seen photos from China and from Dallas of bikes in trees, bikes in rivers, you know, people vandalizing the bikes, leaving them all over the place. And so one thing the city wanted to do is have most of the bikes and eventually all the bikes be able to be locked to something, like locked to a bike rack or locked to a signpost. And that's caused some protests from some of the bike companies because their bikes aren't fit to do that and they can't do that.
Right. And locking a bike to a tree is probably not ideal, nor is throwing
well,
it in a river.
Yeah, you don't want to do that. You do want to lock them. It's like for a normal bike, you lock it to a rack or you'd lock it to a street sign or to a parking meter or something like that.
And so the general sense is, move, you know, hopefully moving away from that into something more like a wheel lock and less dependent on being attached to an existing structure is what it sounds like.
Well, most of the bike companies are set up to do that, but Chicago is unique among cities in saying, no, we don't want the problems that Dallas and Shanghai and other places have had. We want bikes to be able to be locked to something so that they're not cluttering the public way. And so they're requiring that by July 1st, all backless bikes be locked to something. And a couple of the bike share companies, OFO and Lime Bike, are saying, no, we don't, you know, you really don't need that. You know, we have crews out, we'll be able to balance the bikes, we'll be able to make sure they're standing upright, we'll educate riders on how to, you know, set them properly so that they don't block the public way. So what we're having right now is, Amy, is this is a test. It's a pilot. You know, the city is going to see what works. And if it works well, the hope is that they'll be able to expand it to more parts of the city and more people will be able to take advantage of bike share. But they really have to test first how it's going to work. And in the next couple months, some of these wheel lock bike share companies want to be able to prove to the city that they don't need this lock to technology. But you know, the city is you know, waiting to see what happens. You know, some of the people I've talked to are relieved that there's going to be lock to requirements because they don't want bikes all over the place.
And then we have Alderman Anthony Beal of the Ninth Ward entering the conversation and saying, no, this is not, seems like this is not the right move. Instead, let's just expand Divvy. And so where does that conversation lead?
Right. Well, Alderman Beal has been asking for a while to have the city-owned Divvy bike share program down in his far south side ward. And he told me this week that he feels like his ward is, by getting these dockless bikes, is getting a substandard kind of program. And he's worried about people just leaving their bikes anywhere. And he says up in the north side, people get these nice new Divvy bikes and we get leftovers. He's complaining justly that Divvy bikes have been slow to coming to the west, to the south side. There are no Divvy stations south of 87th Street. The city responds that, you know, we have spread the Divvy program extensively, and we're committed to extending it more. And they say that the dockless program gives them an opportunity to test this new technology to see how this works, and it might enable them to spread bikes faster than they would under Divvy.
And so theoretically here, we're going to eventually anyway see one solution citywide. Is that the hope?
Well, I think, no, the hope is that it would be a tandem solution. Like we'd have Divi in some places and Dockless in others. That's already being tried in Washington, D.C., and it's working out. They have a system there where people have, you know, docked bikes, and they also have Dockless bikes, and that's working out. And so we might see a kind of a tandem solution here. And so this is what the city's going to try, because right now where the Dockless bikes are where Divi bikes aren't. And so they're just going to see how this works. The Divi system has been very successful, and so they really don't want to mess with it. The other thing about Divi is that it is city-owned, and so the profits that the city gets from advertising with the system are things that come back to the city and are used to pay for bike infrastructure in the city, like bike lanes and education about bikes. So Divi's important to the city. They don't want to cannibalize it.
Mm-hmm. So what is our timeline that we're looking at? You mentioned this is a pilot phase. So what is the next beat, and what are some key dates here?
Oh, sure. Well, they just started it on this past week, and the bikes the bike vendors have 2 months to be able to get locks that can lock the bikes to something. So we have until July 1st. You're going to be able to see both lock two bikes and bikes that just have wheel locks on them. And this program is going to run 6 months through November 1st. And at that time, the city is going to figure out, if they want to expand the program, if they want to keep trying it for a little while longer this way, and, just basically what they're going to do. So if you want to try these bikes, the thing to do would be to go down to the South Side to, between 79th and 138th Street, as far west as Beverly, and give them a spin.
Indeed. And so are there any areas where there is overlap of both bike solutions?
Just a little bit, because the Dockless bikes start at 79th Street and the Divi stations go as far as 87th. So it's a little bit, but not too much.
Okay, so a tiny bit, but it'll be interesting to watch those areas in particular just to see what people kind of gravitate to, what seems more convenient, cost-effective, things like that. Very interesting.
Oh, yeah, and it'll be great to see, where people leave the bikes. See if people, do it in a good way or in a careless way. So far, the reports I've heard have been good.
Right, hopefully no more rivers and trees. Like in other cities.
Right. Exactly. We don't want to see that.
Right. Well, Mary Wisniewski, thanks so much for being with us. And if for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'm going to be sure and tweet this story out so you can read the latest. It's really, really interesting, this step that the city's taking. Thanks so much, Mary.
Okay, thank you.
All right, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, we're going to talk about some numbers connected to Kentucky Derby, which is happening just a little bit later today. Back in just a bit, 720 WGN. WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Just hours from now, my friends, the greatest 2 minutes in sports is happening, and that is the Kentucky Derby, and we're going to be updating you through the afternoon. I'm a big fan of Derby, but, here on the Business Lunch, we're always looking at the economic impact of stuff and looking at numbers, and there's some really interesting numbers I want to share with you around the Derby. It is regionally, right there around Louisville, it is a $400 million impact on the area. An interesting addition of that is that Airbnb sees a huge uptick, of course, because I've gone to several Derbies. I've worked them and gone as just a spectator, and it is very difficult to find a hotel room. I have ended up staying very far away just because it was kind of a last minute get down there thing. And it was like, well, all right, so I'm going to commute 45 minutes to the Derby. It's really difficult. People buy people like lock their hotel rooms in right then. And so Airbnb has been a really interesting solution. I mean, I'm not going to lie. If I lived in Louisville, I would absolutely be like, I'm going to peace out. Y'all can, I'm going to Airbnb my place. For some astronomical amount of cash, have at it.
Yeah.
I absolutely would.
I know that. I mean, that's just, some people think about that now when they're picking a place. Like,
that's smart.
Is Airbnb-able?
I mean, my place is real clean, but nothing ever happens in my neighborhood now. So I guess it's Airbnb-able. But yeah. So $400 million regional impact in the state of Kentucky, it makes for about 55,000 jobs, which is really great and interesting. Also, the record number of tickets sold was 513. That was in 2015. I was at that one.
170,000?
Yeah.
You were at that one? You were one of that number?
I was one of that number. 513 without me would have been 512.
Wow.
Yeah, I was at that one.
So that place can hold that many people? I mean, obviously.
Oh my God.
It can hold more?
Well, because you have the stands. Yeah. You have people that go for many reasons. You have people that are sitting out in the stands and in the seating, like arena style. Then you have the infield crowd that's really just kind of there to party and be crazy. Then you have people that are just like up in the jockey club and inside. They just want to kind of socialize. There's some fancy receptions that happen. People are watching on TVs. Then there's the skyboxes. There's a ton of people. And then there's people with no tickets. They're just out in the parking lot tailgating.
Right.
And then there's people. Then that night you go out in your hat and your stuff. And if you either drink your sorrows away or you splurge for a little, maybe not the well cocktail. You get an upgrade if you did okay. So it's kind of an interesting scene because everybody's still kind of in derby mode when they go out. So
there's just so much that I don't understand about horse racing. But yeah,
I got you covered on that.
I know. I guess. How did you get into it so much? What's this origin story?
Marathon coaching.
How so?
Because I was coaching runners for marathons, and I started realizing that made it click in my head, like to plan out how soon you can run another marathon at optimal condition. It just sort of clicked that, like, well, that horse just ran a race. Of course it's going to be slower. He just did one. And so I started looking at the horses like athletes. And then I started learning to factor in other things. And so I have a whole thing. Like, I look at weather. Is that horse a good mudder? Some horses just don't like rain in their face. Some horses do really well in grass. And
it's supposed to be wet today, right?
It is supposed to be. Yeah. I'm good at picking mudders. I just assume horses are real temperamental and go from there. Assume the worst of the horses. But then you have to look at who's the trainer. What's their track record? And we spend a lot of time looking at the sire, but we don't look often at the mare. And so that's important to look at, too. You got to look at lots of things with the horsies. So some other numbers for you. This weekend, on average, 120,000 mint juleps will be consumed. 120,000 mint juleps.
So if you guess, I know that was a record number, but if there's about 170,000 people there, almost all, like two-thirds of them are going to have a mint julep, and the rest are children.
And here's here's the thing. I've sat in that crowd in many different spots of that crowd, and ain't nobody drinking one mint julep. People are having like 10. There are several mint juleps happening. And when it's, there's just like at a baseball game, there's people walking around with like a... There's guys just walking around and screaming, julep, like, oh, there you great. Go. So they're plentiful. They're easy. There was a number I think we found on the show for last year. I couldn't find it for this year. But there was a number we found. It was the amount of – it was the mint crop.
Right.
Of like how many pounds of mint are consumed. there was a bar some local bars were – they were being polled about this. And someone said something like 15 pounds of mint just like here in a bar.
Right.
Which is kind of absurd and unheard of. But interesting detail, though. We were talking about mares a minute ago. Only three fillies have been winners.
And I, I'm sorry. A filly is...
Girl horses.
Oh, wow.
They're usually male.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Only three.
Only three.
That's fascinating.
And 144 years. So only
good for them.
That was Regent in 1915.
Of course.
What was the other one's name? 1980. I can't remember that horse's name. And then... Winning Colors in 1988.
1988 is the most recent one?
Yeah, yeah.
Gosh, I got to keep an eye on that. That is fascinating.
I think it's very interesting how people pick horse names pick horses, too, because I think so many people are like, I don't know, I just like the names. I'm not going to lie, Good Magic this year, that's a great horsey name. But a lot of people are looking at Justify right now. But on Derby Day, you got to look at so much stuff because it changes hour by hour and horses get temperamental and sometimes they don't feel like running. So there you go. But we'll keep you updated and we'll be checking in throughout the afternoon on Derby Day. We're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff back in just a bit here on 720 WGN.